Thank you for joining us today at Mormon Stories. A few quick reminders. If you're interested in attending either of our August 4th Sunstone workshops, the morning session focusing on navigating an LDS faith crisis in or out of the church, and the afternoon session focusing on navigating a marriage when one of you loses their testimony, please email us today. Space will be limited. Second, if you are interested in joining the private Mormon Stories internet web forum, where you can meet and discuss Mormonism in privacy with others like you, please send me an email via Facebook to let me know of your interest. And finally, if you value what we're doing here at Mormon Stories and want to keep this program alive past July 2010, please consider signing up today to become a monthly paid subscriber to Mormon Stories. All donations are tax deductible. They will go directly to the time and materials used to produce the show. And you can sign up for as little as $5 a month at MormonStories.org. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy the show. Hi, this is John. Before we begin this episode, I just wanted to give you a few program notes. First, I wanted to introduce you to Andrew Ainsworth. Andrew is a close personal friend and a longtime Mormon Stories listener, and he'll be conducting the interview today. He's an attorney by trade, and he's very well prepared for this interview, and I think you'll see that from the get-go. I also want to introduce you to Damon Smith. Damon has written a fantastic and interesting book. He's an anthropologist by trade, and he's worked inside church headquarters. So if you've ever wanted to know a little bit more about post-manifesto polygamy, the polygamy that happened after the church said it was going to stop polygamy, if you ever wanted to understand more about the church's changing identity in the 1900s, how we went from a polygamist sort of faction into a mainstream church, if you ever wanted to understand about correlation in the church and how, correlated and systematized our manuals are today, maybe even a bit dull and dry at times, Damon will be talking about that. And then finally, if you've ever wondered about how the church runs as a corporation, its finances, how it makes tough decisions, and even about the new City Creek Mall that's being built, Damon's got a lot of insider information about that as well. So this is a fantastic podcast. It's several hours long, but it's well worth a listen. So please check it out, and thanks again for joining us today on Mormon Stories.
Damon Smith, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thank you, Andrew. I was going to read your script you provided for me here, but it's a pleasure to be here.
That's an inside joke, folks. The script says, thank you, Andrew. I'm a huge fan of yours. I practically worship you, actually, and it's a great honor just to be talking to you. But we'll skip that.
Yeah, I was planning on making the conversation about whether you can serve Andrew and Mammon or Andrew and God. That's how it is for me.
Well, you're jumping ahead. Let me start you where John usually likes to start his guests, which is to ask you to give us a summary of your background, your upbringing in the church, pivotal experiences that shaped your understanding of the church and your relationship with it, as well as any background experiences that have shaped your worldview.
Yeah, I mean, I was born here in Utah Valley. I come from a large family. I've got 10 brothers and sisters. One of these kind of old school Mormon families in a fairly old school Mormon community in Pleasant Grove, where there's a lot of, really large families. So I had a sense of Mormonism as really kind of an all-encompassing thing. It really was, your community was perfectly aligned with your religion. So that was kind of my early childhood. Then I moved up to Idaho as a teenager, and sort of, I imagine, had a fairly common experience up there. So I raised in the church, and of course, being raised in the church, I never really took any of it very seriously. Went to seminary, slept through most of it, even though it was during school hours, and really didn't give much much attention to these kinds of matters of religion. It was something which, honestly, I can't recall too many Sunday school lessons that I heard as a child or as a teenager, except there was one about my teacher was saying that in the millennium we'll find out who actually killed JFK. My experience...
That's exciting.
Finally, the answer will be resolved. I went from that to... deciding to that I was going to go on a mission. And at the time, I didn't really believe in much of anything. It just seemed like a pretty interesting adventure, and most of my friends were going, which I imagine is not so different from a lot of guys who fill out their paperwork. When I was in the MTC, however, I actually opened up the Book of Mormon and took it seriously and decided I better figure this thing out. If I'm going to be out there preaching it and teaching people about it, I better, in some sense, decide whether I really want to be an advocate for this book and for this religion. And when I was there, I had one of those sort of standard experiences where, in some sense, I obtained a testimony that it was true. But this put me in kind of an awkward position. I had to then go and decide if I was going to confess to certain things that I had done prior to my mission. If I wanted to do the mission correctly, then I needed to, in some sense, start with a clean record. And I did this, and these were, I found out later, apparently minor things, but it was of such seriousness that they sent me home. So this was 6 weeks into my mission. And I actually really loved the MTC. I thought I had a great time there. I actually enjoyed the food, which gives you some sense of my upbringing. my mom wasn't much of a cook. So, you know, that sort of brings me up to... I started to kind of go off track here a little bit from the standard Mormon experience, I think. And but I also, I think, kind of grounded my belief very much in my own personal experience, as much as a lot of Mormons do, probably. So I really became kind of a deinstitutionalized Mormon, I think, at that point, and really went off on a very different track than I think a lot of people would take. I was married in the temple a year and a half later to my wife. I have three children, and after that, I decided to take life a little more seriously.
Well, let me just jump in, because I've got a couple questions. But before you move on too much, you know, you're a guy who's gone on to basically devote your career to the study of the church, and you obviously have a very academic bent. And I'm just wondering, at what point in your life did that sort of academic approach to religion, to the church, kick in for you?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I can't really pinpoint, to be honest. I was, again, not terribly interested in Mormonism as a youth. I didn't read a lot of books on Mormonism or anything else. It really, I think, happened when I was at the University of Utah, and I took a class from David Knowlton, who's one of these few Mormon anthropologists. He was just began teaching there, I believe, the semester that I took his class. And he taught a class on myth, magic, and religion, and then he taught another class on anthropology of religion, and I was blown away. I couldn't imagine actually studying this kind of stuff and making a living while you're doing it. So that really was kind of the first opening for me, was the idea that you could study something like religion as an anthropologist and not necessarily have to convert or be an advocate for or against the religion. Anthropology provides a nice, sort of comfortable framing to neutralize these questions of conversion or disaffiliation, and allows you to really take questions seriously that the religion poses, but not necessarily convert. So I think I was kind of slowly led into the study of Mormonism that way. And from there, I did some research with David Knowlton on missionaries and masculinity and their sort of experience of masculinity through this prism of morality, which is kind of the way that we reckon masculinity in kind of the modern world. And really began to develop a love for doing these kinds of ethnographic research and field work and interviews with people who were very different from me, who had different experiences from me, and begin to sort of fall in love with the idea of a puzzle that anthropology presents, which is, how do you understand something like Mormonism as a cultural phenomenon without necessarily beginning to wrestle with the questions of whether its claims are true or false? And so from there, I applied to a number of graduate schools to get a doctoral degree in anthropology, and ended up at the University of Pennsylvania, where there was he was in the anthropology department, but he wasn't actually an anthropologist, named Melvin Hammerberg. And he kind of brought me in, and my original intention was to study Mormonism, contemporary Mormonism, from the perspective of psychological anthropology. I eventually moved away from this psychological approach and began to take up a much more historical approach to the study of Mormonism, rather. And there are a number of reasons why I leaned much more heavily towards historical versus psychological approaches. And the main one was that I realized that in order to understand something like modern Mormonism, you had to understand correlation. And my original insight was I was asked to teach a lesson in Elders Quorum on correlation. So in some sense, my Elders Quorum president is to blame for the entire trajectory that I've taken since then.
Well, that provides a perfect segue to go right into discussing your dissertation. I understand you did your dissertation on the history of correlation, and it's a very lengthy work. And for those who are interested in reading the entire dissertation, I should just let you know up front, you should check out the By Common Consent website, where Damon Smith and Brad Kramer did a really excellent 9-part series where they took Damon's, 400 to 500 page dissertation and basically boiled it down to the Reader's Digest version. Is that about right?
Yeah. It's about 500 or so pages. And I think it's shorter on the blog, though. Certain people were complaining about the 9-part series.
Well, what I was hoping, you know, if that was the Reader's Digest version, what I was hoping we could do is in this podcast is to give our listeners an even more abbreviated Cliff Notes version of your dissertation. And I have to start by thanking you because your dissertation made me fall even deeper in love with Mormon history. Because it illuminated this period of church history that often gets overlooked in our official histories, and that's that basically that gap of time between the manifesto in 1890 that purportedly ended practice of plural marriage up through, say, the beginning of the Great Depression in 1829. And it seems that in official church histories, not much is said about this period. Except, you know, we get the story about Lorenzo Snow emphasizing the importance of tithing and getting the church out of debt. But other than that, in official histories of the church, this you know, roughly 40-year period is somewhat of a black hole in church history that we average Mormons don't really seem to know much about. And yet, it is such a fascinating, turbulent, transformative period that serves as this sort of missing link between the Church of Joseph and Brigham and the modern church of today. So just to frame our discussion of your dissertation a bit more, because there is a lot of content in there, and like I said, I want to do like a Cliff Notes version. This was my takeaway, and maybe you can kind of that I was hoping would frame this discussion, and you can kind of correct me if I didn't get it right, but I see you really identifying three main sets of chain reactions that become the major driving forces towards correlation. And that first set of chain reactions begins with the federal prosecution of church leaders and members, which then causes Mormons to adopt a widespread practice of saying one thing to the feds, but doing another to continue living their religion while attempting to avoid or thwart prosecution. And that then creates confusion among church leaders and members when the 1890 manifesto comes along about whether that should be taken seriously, whether the church leaders really mean it, which in turn creates a debate about the true succession of the priesthood keys and results in the Mormon fundamentalist movement, which then creates a need to formulate a on the part of the modern LDS church, a sort of seamless historical and doctrinal narrative that links the Church of Joseph to the modern LDS church. And why don't we start then, just if you could just take us then to the beginning of that first set of chain reactions with the federal prosecution of church leaders and members over polygamy. Take us back to 1890 and just sort of paint the historical scene for us and take us into how that federal prosecution affected the way Mormons used language.
Yeah, this was something which was sort of pointed to me by the writing of Carmen Hardy, who's a historian who covers some of the transitional eras in Mormonism, with a focus on polygamy and post-manifesto polygamy. D. Michael Quinn's work, of course, and Sarah Gordon, who's a law professor at Penn. And I realized that my training in linguistic anthropology was perfectly suited to begin to approach this, what you rightly point out, is really a kind of black box in Mormon history, which is this era from the 1880s up until really the 1920s, 1930s. So the 1880s is a really, really interesting and difficult time. What you have is the federal government inventing a new crime called unlawful cohabitation. And they had to invent this crime because they couldn't really prosecute anybody for polygamy because of certain protections that made it so that a wife couldn't testify against her husband. And of course, the real problem is establishing who is the legal wife and who's the second wife. And this could only be established while you were on the stand. And of course, you couldn't allow the testimony, which was then pronounced on the stand. So the federal government had a real conundrum, which was how do we get these guys to stop their practice of plural marriage, which really was the interest, which is kind of the public face of a much more realpolitik kind of interest, which was how do we destroy their political and economic power in the West?
Mm-hmm.
So the of course polygamy was the easiest hammer to use here, and so they invented this crime, unlawful cohabitation, and over about a year from 1884 to about 1886. The evidentiary standards really got pretty loose to the point where you were committing unlawful cohabitation if somebody believed that somebody else believed you were possibly living in the marriage relation with somebody who was possibly your wife.
Sounds like a perfect recipe for a witch hunt.
And that's exactly what happened. And so you, as soon as you put that kind of authority to enunciate, you know, the criminal behavior can just be basically pronounced from the witness stand, it creates the kind of paranoia that you saw with the witch hunts. So my interest in this era was how did language play a role in the sort of creation of this paranoia? And then how did the response by the Mormons who were sort of in the crosshairs of this, of the feds, the marshals, and what came to be called the spies. What was the response, and how did this affect Mormonism? And so, what I do in the dissertation is I go through the development of newspaper reports of spies, and there's an increasing generalization and sort of ambiguity. With respect,
and I'm sorry, just to jump in. When you say spies, we're talking about federal agents who are disguised as Mormons, just sort of trying to blend into the Mormon community, or are these members of the church who are being paid by federal authorities to spy, or is it both?
Well, that's the question that they were asking at the time: is who exactly is a spy? And of course, a spy is somebody who hides their identity, right? So you can imagine that the paranoia ramped up pretty quickly, because if somebody's walking by your down the street and you don't know this person, maybe that's a spy.
Yeah.
Right. So what you actually have here is a series of really kind of tragic and comedic misunderstandings, where polygamists who were on the run from what they perceived to be federal agents, these spies who were sort of in the pay of the marshals, or maybe not even in the pay of the marshals, they're on the run from these guys, and they enter into a town that they're not recognized in, and they create a kind of chain reaction of people fleeing because they're perceived as a spy.
So you leave your home, you go to the adjoining town, you show up in this new town, people don't know who you are, you must be a spy, and so that causes a group of guys to flee that town and go to the next town where the same thing happens repeatedly.
That's right. And so and this was really exacerbated by the what was then regarded as the only Mormon creed that we've ever had, which was mind your own business.
Was that an official creed, or that's a term that you sort of used to describe it?
It was called the Mormon Creed, and it was on the it was on the sort of banner head of John Taylor's newspaper. It was something.
And
which,
it said, "Mind your own business."
That's right. That was the
just a four-word creed.
Yeah. Simple enough, It had certain virtues, but it also really created all kinds of problems in this kind of environment, because the polygamists would be following the creed and minding their own business because they were told in the newspapers that this was the only proper response to the persecution that they were experiencing, was to basically mind your own business, because the only way you could determine who was a spy was people who asked impertinent questions or people who maybe were looking at you. And of course, the problem is that a spy is looking at you, though you don't know that they're looking at you. So there was a problem of surveillance, which could never be verified in any of these guesses that somebody was a spy. And so as a result, it was really easy to guess somebody was a spy. And just to be helpful, you might send a letter to the editor of the Territorial Enquirer and say, "Hey, there's a spy who I saw yesterday walking down the street." And of course, this would create all kinds of paranoia among the readers, because usually the descriptions were so vague as to more or less include anybody. And then these reports would get picked up through a kind of syndication, and you might find a couple days later a report in the Ogden newspaper or in the Salt Lake papers about spies in their midst as well. And so the creed to mind your own business really made it impossible to determine who was a spy and who was a polygamist, who was then what began to be called on the underground. And so the underground became a kind of discursive space, which was created through your ability to, in some sense, hide your identity through language. And they had a lot of prescriptions that they would give to kids, that they would give to polygamists, that they would give to the wives of polygamists, in order to protect men who were on the run or who were on the underground. And these prescriptions are pretty clear, that you're not obliged to answer any questions people put to you, but more importantly, if you can misdirect them, if you can point their attentions in another to another area, all the better. These are sort of soft ways of saying you're not obliged to tell the truth to anybody who asks you a question, and anybody who asks you a question is possibly a suspect person.
So just to provide an example, I mean, it just a sort of a normal, ordinary conversation you might have with meeting someone the first time back then, you know, kind of questions you ask people you meet at church for the first time is, "Oh, are you married? You know, do you have any children? How old are they?" Etc. How would those sort of simple, seemingly innocuous questions gone over back then?
Well, the proper response to a question like that is mind your own business.
Yeah.
and this was actually, it wasn't regarded as a rude thing. So there's an account of Annie Tanner in her book, Mormon Mother, where Wilford Woodruff asks her the question of who is her child's father, which seems like not such a prying question. But she basically told him to mind his own business. So, you know, even things like who are you married to? Who is your son-in-law? These were the kinds of questions which were regarded as impertinent and potentially kinds of surveillance which the feds would use to throw somebody in jail. The 1880s is really the place where I decided to locate this massive transition from the Mormonism of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young into its kind of modern formation. In large part because what you had here was the leadership really falling apart. And a real kind of discursive divide is kind of the phrase I'm going to use for it, where you were expected as a good Mormon to say one thing to one audience and to say another thing to another audience. And the more kind of in the role of a leader you were, either in the local communities or in the church itself, the more you were expected to abide by this kind of a norm. It was really was kind of a marker of being an authentic Mormon, was your ability to mind your own business and to obligate other people to mind their own business by virtue of your ability to obfuscate, let's say.
You also use some examples of this sort of emergence of speaking in code. In addition to sort of telling people to mind their own business, speaking in code develops, and you provide this humorous example of a bishop's son going to a neighboring farmer and talking to him about cows. I was hoping you could provide that. It's such a funny example for our readers, because I think it really gives you a good humorous understanding of the levels of distrust that had been created because of this federal prosecution.
Yeah, it was one of the Batemans, and they were often on bodyguards of John Taylor, who's of course on the run at the time. He dies in 1887 while on the run, and they call him a martyr. So these are the Bateman boys, and you know they were a pretty burly group, and they were also kind of the most paranoid, because their job was to protect the president. Now, whether they needed to protect the president is another matter. There was all kinds of bribes that went around that sort of secured their protection, but that's kind of a different story. So in this example, you have Bateman goes down to the farm, and he's sort of having a conversation with one of these farmers, and he's asked by the farmer to basically go ask another guy if they have any new cows, I believe was the phrase. I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing, but he's asking a question about cows or new calves.
I seem to remember it being something like, if you have any extra cows, leave the fattest ones outside the barn and the bishop will come get them later, or something like that.
Yeah, it was just such a random sort of a question. And he goes away, and initially he doesn't make anything out of it, but the more he thinks on it, the more the paranoia begins to sort of interpret the experience for him, and he decides that he is the fatted calf, and that the marshals, that this is a speaking in code, that the marshals are actually after him, so he flees. So what happened here is the paranoia made you and every individual person who's sort of viewed themselves as a target, the subject of all these secret codes. And they actually did develop a formal code as well, but it wasn't used that much, mainly because you had to teach people the code. It's much easier to just sort of assume everything is a code. And so, you know, this is what is the foundation then for the issuance of the manifesto, of Wilford Woodruff's manifesto in 1890, is you have a community of people who, if they've been trained in this underground culture, they in some sense expect a statement which is uttered in public, to whom it may concern, is literally who it is addressed to. They expect something like this to be a smokescreen, to say one thing, which is not necessarily the sincere God's truth of the matter. And then you have another group, and this is kind of where the eventual schism occurs, this sort of very soft cleavage line that fractures Mormon culture. You've got a group who is really being raised at the time in monogamous households, and they are, in some sense, really pretty isolated or separated from what is going on in the underground among the polygamists and their development of this kind of ability to say one thing and to mean another. And they're called in the newspapers Young Utah. And so Young Utah becomes something that the newspapers fix upon as kind of the new hope for Mormonism, that maybe they won't all be polygamous, socialist, communist patriarchs, but maybe there really is kind of a new crop that is going to come forth.
Can you give us an idea of the breakdown of all Mormons back then? Roughly what percentage would have been polygamist, you know, part of this underground movement, part of, you know, basically this atmosphere of distrust and paranoia and the sort of culture of saying one thing and doing another to kind of throw off the feds?
Yeah, it's tough to put any real solid numbers on it, but, you know, the lowest estimates of the number of men who were involved in polygamy is like 3%, which is, I think, very conservative. You know, but even if you just take that very low number, if you take the average number of wives that these men had, let's say 3, and then the number of children that each of these wives had, let's say 4, you can begin to see the number of people who are just involved, who are very much legally connected and have an interest in the well-being of this. Of this polygamist who's on the run starts to really move up pretty quickly.
Is it safe to say as well that... Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off there.
Oh, I was just going to say that the network of the underground included monogamous because they were viewed as kind of safe houses. And so the number of people who are actually involved in it goes up pretty high. But there's a kind of weird division that occurs, whereas the people who can actually sort of create and interpret underground discourse is a much smaller segment than the number of people who are kind of involved in and sort of follow the basic creed of mind your own business. So you might end up at somebody's house who isn't a polygamist and has nothing to do with polygamy, but they will know not to ask you any questions. So their assumption is, you know, let's just keep our mouth shut and that's a way to protect people. This is kind of the way that the monogamous would have operated. The polygamists, on the other hand, would have had a much more complicated, and they do have a much more complicated understanding. You see it in their letters. So there's a great deal of discussion in the dissertation about the letters of Joseph F. Smith to his wives and to his friends. And there really was a lot of conflict among the wives because they were hearing different stories about where he was going to be living and where he was living at the time. So they didn't even actually have his address. They didn't know if he was in Utah, in Hawaii, in New Zealand, in England, in Washington. They heard different stories. And if there was a confirmation that, let's say, he was in New Zealand and one of his wives thought he was in New Zealand and she turned out to be right, the other wives, of course, would be pretty hurt by this revelation because they would think that perhaps Joseph F. trusted that wife with that information more than he trusted the other wives. And so the households themselves really started to break down. And, you know, and you see this kind of thing going on, and the monogamous households are brought in, but not at the level of an understanding of the kind of value of deception. They and even the polygamists themselves really kind of resented the fact that they had to lie all the time and they had to hide all the time. You know, they viewed this as kind of engaging really in borderline sinful activity, and you know their standards were really pretty high.
Well, how did people deal with that? I mean, because nowadays, I mean, there's pretty much a pretty clear cut ethic about you know, you say what you mean and mean what you say. How did church leaders and other members of the underground? I mean, did you ever uncover any letters or sermons or anything like that where they sort of explain that there's some sort of divine authorization to deceive in this context?
Yeah, I mean, one of the examples is Nephi in the Book of Mormon, who not only kills his religious authority, assassinates him, but then dresses up like him in order to deceive people. So that was one of the examples that they would trot out as justification. But the basic idea was that when you're being persecuted by the forces of darkness, that you have to do what you have to do in order to protect the flock.
Yeah, so there's no sin in deceiving the devil or the forces of the devil.
That's right, though they knew that this is a very dangerous kind of dance to engage in. And you know, Joseph F. Smith, you know, wrote letters to Charles Penrose and to Charles Nibley, sort of lamenting this fact that they had to lie all the time, and that in some sense they were raising, as they said, a generation of deceivers, children who were being taught to say one thing about who their dad was, to say they didn't know who their dad was, for example, or they didn't know who their mom was, or they didn't know who their brothers were, or they didn't know where they lived, that they had to teach their children these things really was a very, very difficult thing and played a much more significant role in accepting the manifesto than I think we're apt to realize.
Yeah, I think when I was reading about this, I thought it started to make so much more sense to me. The manifesto started to make so much more sense when you sort of kind of between the lines here, President Woodruff saying, you know, we're just really in a completely unworkable situation, and you know. I'd always known about the federal prosecution and people having to be on the run, but I honestly had no idea the extent to which it affected Mormon culture and even just communications between family members, between neighbors. I mean, it really was a complete breakdown of communication. You just never knew if someone was telling the truth, if someone really wanted the cows, or if they were telling you to run away from the marshals.
Yeah, it was something which went all the way up into the first presidency, where George Q. Cannon is being accused of keeping Joseph F. Smith away, and sort of scaring him with all these stories of spies haunting his residence. And you've got Joseph F. Being accused of certain things by other people in the Quorum of the Twelve. And the Quorum of the Twelve really began to suspect one another of maybe not necessarily being a spy, but of having a loose tongue, of maybe writing something in a letter that maybe tipped the feds, who maybe intercepted the mail. And so you get a lot of real sense of the thing that really broke the movement was not the financial aspect, not the difficulties that they endured. Mormons were pretty hardy folk and had endured worse persecution than this. But what broke it was a kind of soft exercise of power, which the Mormons were very much complicit in, and that was the development of distrust as the kind of overriding assumption in Mormons, that you couldn't trust anybody. Even if you trusted them to not, you know, go to the feds, you couldn't trust the person that they might talk to. And so distrust really was the thing that broke it all apart, alongside this kind of paranoia where you know, every individual was a target at all times. It's this distrust which really is the kind of stark feature when you read their journals and when you read their letters. They didn't know who was on whose side. And in that kind of situation, again, they began to really look out for themselves first and foremost.
So before we get to the manifesto, can you say a word about loyalty tests? Because that certainly, these loyalty tests really explain a lot of the confusion when the brethren later try to enforce the ban on plural marriage. So what were the loyalty tests that the members were subjected to before the manifesto came out in 1890?
Well, in order to vote, they had to say that they didn't believe in polygamy or that they weren't polygamous. And this created certain problems in Idaho where they actually excommunicated whole congregations so that they could vote. And then they could say that they weren't members of the Mormon Church. And this really was a pretty drastic strategy for these guys to take. And the idea was that then they would, of course, bring them all back. But as soon as you begin to sort of play with people's membership and their covenants as a way to vote, it's hard to say kind of where you're going to draw the line. And so the question for a lot of these guys is, you know, where do we draw the line? What do we need to give up? And what are we willing to not give up? And, you know, they regularly sent letters, the monogamous in particular, sent letters to John Taylor asking him to basically allow them to write a state constitution which banned polygamy, all the while you would go and teach people on the side that we don't practice polygamy, we practice plural marriage, or we practice celestial marriage. So it's a completely different thing. You know, we'll just ban Gentile polygamy. And as one of these kind of tests that you're asking about, Wilford Woodruff presented an unsigned document which basically said that the Latter-day Saints are not going to practice plural marriage anymore. They're not going to teach it. They're not going to advocate it. It's no longer going to be a part of their religion.
And this is before the manifesto.
That's right. This is in 1888 and then in 1889. And it was put to the youngest members of the Quorum first, put into a position of a really difficult spot. One by one, they all say that they can't sign something like that, that they can't give up that kind of thing, even if it's just a matter of a kind of smokescreen, that they can't do it. And Woodruff says, well, great, this was just a test to see if you really are loyal. Whether it really was or not is a different matter, because, of course, 18 months later, virtually the same document is signed by Woodruff, not really written by him, but signed by him. And a lot of these guys in the Quorum actually don't hear about it until they read it in the newspapers. So it's actually published in the newspapers before it is presented to the congregation at the General Conference in fall of 1890. And of course, once it's in print, there's not much these apostles can do about it. So the question of loyalty then becomes, it really moves much more into a kind of public sphere performance of loyalty, and really the first kind of example of this is in that 1890 General Conference, where they're presented with two documents. First one's the Articles of Faith, where they're asked to basically sustain this as a guiding creed of the Church, with particular emphasis on the 12th Article of Faith, which says, basically, we agree to follow the laws of the land. And, of course, this was just laying the groundwork for then the presentation of the manifesto. You vote for the Articles of Faith. How do you then decline the manifesto? So the manifesto passed, of course. It's not to say it was unanimous. Apparently there were a lot of people who didn't raise their hand one way or the other. They followed the basic underground creed of not saying anything, minding your own business. And of course, the manifesto is issued into this environment where people have very complicated ways of reading a text from somebody like Wilford Woodruff. So this really does create a lot of problems. And no matter how many times Woodruff says, we don't believe in polygamy and we don't practice it anymore, it's really easy to find evidence of apostles and other church leaders who read that kind of a statement or declaration as actually meaning the opposite, as meaning we really do practice it, and the faithful will read between the lines and understand this this strategy that we have to do.
Yeah, so if you're an average church member, or I guess average general authority there at that general conference. And it seems like in this sort of context of distrust, of paranoia, this history of saying one thing but doing another in order to throw off the feds while living our religion, it seems like it would be very understandable for there to be confusion amongst the church leadership and members about whether when they voted on this is this just sort of a sham, a further effort to pull the wool over the Fed's eyes, or is Wilford Woodruff speaking as a prophet and telling us that God's will literally is for us to discontinue this practice?
Yeah, and they would point to Abraham as an example, where the Lord told him to lie, tell a kind of soft lie about Sarah, who was apparently a half-sister, but he told Pharaoh that she wasn't his sister, or wasn't his wife, but was his sister. So the thing that really got me interested in that era is there was so much dispute over the manifesto, what it really meant. And I read a lot of fundamentalist books about the manifesto. I read a lot of responses to the fundamentalist books by Latter-day Saints about the manifesto. And it became clear that the answer was not, does the manifesto mean one thing? But the problem was, how do I account for the many interpretations of the manifesto as a kind of historical development? And so this is where I position the underground as, in some sense, explaining the fact that there are many manifestos. The 1890 manifesto, yeah, there's a single copy, you know, a single document you can go and look at. But with every copy, there was, in some sense, another interpretation of what it really meant. And Mormons were very careful about it. They, in public, would always say that, you know, that they absolutely didn't doubt the manifesto. But the national newspapers, the national press, really doubted it. They viewed Mormons as being inherently deceptive. That was just one segment of what made them un-American and even anti-American. So the newspapers were very skeptical about it and continued to be skeptical throughout the 1890s. Even with statehood in 1896, which was viewed as, in some sense, the completion of this bargain that they had made, where if they give up polygamy, we'll give you statehood. The idea among the apostles, at least those who had strategies about statehood, was that once they had statehood, then they could write their own constitution, they could practice polygamy, and they'd have power over the courts to prosecute or not prosecute polygamists. Of course, the feds saw right through that kind of a strategy and required a clause in there that forever forbid polygamy. This didn't, of course, stop many people, including possibly Wilford Woodruff, from taking a wife as late as 1896, 1897, even 1898. Wilford Woodruff's son, Abraham Woodruff, and, of course, the number of church leaders who were involved in post-manifesto polygamy, as the work of D. Michael Quinn and other historians makes clear, is really pretty hard to say that that they were rogue apostles, or that they were somehow misunderstood what Woodruff really meant. I mean, I have a hard time believing Woodruff somehow didn't understand what he himself meant by it. So, of course, Woodruff didn't actually write the thing, which in some sense complicates the idea that Woodruff was telling a lie, or that the Lord was telling him to tell a lie. He was very careful about his explanation of where it came from. He said that the Lord told him to issue it. Now, that's a different thing from saying that the Lord wrote it, or that Woodruff dictated at the voice of the Lord this thing.
Or even that the Lord actually wants us to go through with this.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, if he says the Lord wants me to issue this statement, you can see people who are still wedded to plural marriage saying, well, yeah, the Lord was just asking you to issue the statement to further pull the wool over the Fed's eyes. The Lord didn't actually expect you to go through with it.
That's right. And so what happens here is the interpretation of the manifesto itself becomes a kind of loyalty test. Are you really on the Lord's side? You can answer that question by saying, yes, because I'm taking another wife, you know, as late as 1905, 1906, 1907. Or you could say, yes, I'm on the Lord's side because I am a monogamous and have been since 1890. And these are both equally valid ways of being a Mormon up until 1910. So again, like the complication here is that it's not as if you have true Mormons and Mormons who are just confused, or fringe Mormons, or perverted Mormons. Both of these are legitimate ways of being a Mormon at the time. And again, there's really no way you can break out one group from another group, because you can stand up and have Joseph F. Smith say, you know, 1904, no, we're serious, we really don't practice polygamy. And on the side, you've got apostles who are going around performing plural marriages and saying that this is what the faithful will really interpret it as. And so again, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this was one thing that was just kind of differs from my upbringing and what I learned about polygamy in the manifesto, or which was little growing up. And I think maybe the sense I'm guessing amongst most members of the church whose knowledge of this period is going to be pretty limited to having read only those materials that have made it through correlation. The idea is that Wilford Woodruff got up, issued read a statement, it was voted on, it was accepted, and that was the end of polygamy. And obviously, you and other historians have pointed out that that's just simply not the case, that it continued for a few more decades. But we know that at some point, I mean, and we know this because today the LDS Church is not polygamist anymore.
As far as we know, so, right.
So that at some point, obviously, monogamy carries the day. And why don't you take us to that point of that sort of growing pain where you have the leaders pulling in two different directions? And I think this is probably where it's appropriate to bring John W. Taylor, John Taylor's son, onto the scene.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the early 1900s, Utah got its first senator in Reed Smoot, who was an apostle. And he's a very kind of complicated figure. He was a monogamist, apparently, though they tried to paint him as a secret monogamist, or a secret polygamist, rather, who was just going to do the will of Joseph F. Smith. And so there was the Smoot hearings occupied several years, in which the Senate brought in various experts. They brought in apostles to testify before them, and Joseph F. Smith was one of these guys who was brought in to testify, and his testimony really was a debacle. I mean, he said that basically he violated his own church's rules, that he didn't receive revelation, he received inspiration just like any Methodist might, that he couldn't remember the names of his wives, they didn't know how many kids he had, that he didn't know which you know, which companies he was on the board of directors for.
And was he doing that, though, because he literally didn't remember, or because, again, he's been in an environment where it's not wise to say how many wives you have and what their names are because of prosecution?
Yeah, well, the way that you answer that really determines kind of the trajectory that you're going to follow after this. So if you fall on the side that he must have been tired because it was a long train ride, and really couldn't remember these things, and he really is kind of sincerely given his account of the truth, then you probably weren't really interested in practicing polygamy. If, on the other hand, you view this as kind of old-timey underground Mormonism, where they stand up and say one thing and mean another because they're not accountable to the laws of this land, they're accountable to a higher law, then it made perfect sense that he was saying these things. Though, again, everybody seemed troubled by his testimony, and it was big news across the land. I mean, they really painted him as a fool, and it really did, I think, cause some real problems in the Quorum of the Twelve, and diminished his power quite a bit. So it created all kinds of confusions in the Quorum of the Twelve, where you have somebody like Francis Lyman, who is more or less starting a witch hunt to really rout out these polygamists, root them out. Meanwhile, you've got somebody like John W. Taylor, who says, no, we have to continue practicing plural marriage and also taking new plural wives. And so he and Matthias Kelly and some other apostles got dragged or got subpoenaed to testify before the Senate. They didn't show up.
Can you give us the date range again now that we're just to make sure?
Yeah, we're talking 1903 to 1907.
Okay.
So 1904, Joseph F. Smith issues the Second Manifesto, as it's called. And this is in large part in response to the fact that Taylor and Cowley just refused to show up.
And just for our listeners, can you summarize the Second Manifesto? I mean, does it say we really meant the 1890 Manifesto?
Yeah, we really meant the 1890 Manifesto, and Lorenzo Snow really meant the 1900 Manifesto, and we really meant, you know, everything that we've said about it. That's really, it kind of recounted the history of our declarations in public about polygamy and reaffirmed it. And so, you know, you had sort of marching orders from Lyman to go to every stake in the church and read it and get people to basically sign on to it, raise their hand and agree to it. But of course, while they were there, they would go and perform plural marriages on the side. So, you know, it's one of those things where eventually Taylor and Cowley become targets. In large part because Smoot makes a deal to sacrifice them. And if they can sacrifice those two guys, then it'll show that the Mormons are sincere, at least show enough to satisfy the constituents of the various senators who were on the investigation committee.
And by now, Smoot has been seated. He's a senator.
Not yet. He's well. It's kind of complicated. The sort of trajectory that they take in terms of seating him and then opposing his seat. So I believe he's seated, but then they actually oppose it. That's kind of the process. But he doesn't really sort of become a full voting member of the Senate until 1907, 1908. And again, this is after they've made the sacrifice of Taylor and Cowley, which, if you read letters and diaries at the time, most people understood that it was just a sacrifice, that these guys weren't being removed from the Quorum of the Twelve because they'd done anything necessarily wrong. They were being removed strictly as a measure so that Smoot could get into the Senate. And this actually created a lot of resentment against Smoot in the Quorum as well as among Mormons as well, because Smoot wasn't a very popular guy, even among Mormons, whereas John W. Taylor was wildly popular. He was viewed as the prophet of the Quorum, one of these guys who still manifested these charismatic gifts to give revelations, to heal people. And again, he really was the inheritor of kind of the mantle of his father, and really kind of brought a promise of a revival of this old-school Mormonism. And Taylor really is running, you can sort of see the trajectory of Taylor and Lyman. Lyman, who performed a plural marriage, who sealed one of John W.'s wives to him after the manifesto. Lyman, whose father was an apostle who was excommunicated. Lyman really begins to sort of head up this this purge of the polygamists. And so what he does, he sets up these courts and brings in various patriarchs and sort of relatives of leading figures of the church, and asks them who performed their plural marriage. And of course, these guys would say, well, they took an oath that they would never reveal that. And the more the apostles would press these guys, one of them, Judson Tolman, for example, an old patriarch, the more they'd sort of press Tolman to reveal the name, the more he viewed it as a loyalty test, whether he was really going to keep to his covenants and his oath that he had taken never to reveal the identity of the person who had performed the ceremony.
Plus, so you got someone sitting on the other side of a table from an apostle or a group of apostles. The apostle asking the questions is, you know, tell me, give me names, who authorized this? And he doesn't, again, because of this history, he doesn't view this as an apostle sincerely asking questions, sincerely wanting him to give answers. This, rather, is kind of a continuation of the loyalty tests that have been going on for years.
That's right. And if he passes the loyalty test, maybe he'll be, given greater opportunities and greater blessings, you know, maybe moved into a higher priesthood or something. Plus, sometimes these guys were actually in the room who had performed the ceremony. So you've got, for example, Anthony Ivins, who had performed, he was himself a monogamist, but he had performed all kinds of plural marriages in the Mexican colonies. And, and sometimes they would be asking one of the guys one of these new polygamists who they brought in, who had performed it. And sometimes the guy who had performed it was literally in the room asking the question.
So, I mean, it seems like this helps us understand why it was so difficult to get polygamy to stop on a dime in 1890, because even, you know, well over a decade later, when you have these courts really trying to purge it, you still have people thinking that they're being loyalty tested and that they're the way to be a good Mormon and to show that you are a faithful, true Mormon is not to answer the apostle's question and give him the answer, but to refuse respectfully to answer the question.
That's right. To say that you're willing to suffer any kind of punishment in order to keep your oath that you had taken, which again they sort of took with the seriousness of the temple covenants that people take on. So this really does get resolved, however, by 1910, 1911, by 1912, Taylor and Cowley are punished. Callie is disfellowshipped, and Taylor is actually excommunicated. And with every excommunication, they were very PR adept and made sure that they published the accounts of the excommunication with the Salt Lake Tribune. So the kind of public awareness that there really were excommunications going on really put a different kind of trajectory on to this kind of secret polygamy. And again, drove it underground to where you had, ironically, Mormons doing the same kinds of tactics to polygamists, which had been done to them by the federal government. And so you have here an example where one group of people begins to persecute themselves in order to kind of get rid of the overall persecution or sense of persecution that might possibly happen from the federal government.
In other words, the apostles and whatnot who are conducting these courts would be, you know, going out amongst members of the church and trying to get informers and to inform on their other church members about who is still practicing or who is still entering into polygamous marriages.
That's right. And you had a lot of opposition to this. You know, you had, they had to remove some stake presidents who refused to hold hearings against bishops who were polygamous. You had bishops who refused to bring the name because, you know, the bishop has to bring the name to the stake presidency before the High Council. And you had bishops who just flat out refused to bring these guys before the local High Council. And so that's in some ways why they were dragged up to Salt Lake City to sort of testify before before the circle of apostles in the temple. So yeah, they began to use secret informers and spies, and really by the 1930s under J. Reuben Clark, they literally began to write new kinds of laws which they hoped would exterminate polygamy forever, and they began to literally use informers as well and spies to break into these secret groups, which again takes us into this new kind of Mormonism called fundamentalism.
Yeah, and so before we get started with that, let's spend just a little bit more time with John W. Taylor and Cowley. Now, Cowley, you mentioned, was disfellowshipped, but am I recalling correctly that he was disfellowshipped, but then he was promptly sent on a mission to India?
Oh, no, was that him? That was Joe Musser, who eventually is the leader of the fundamentalist movement.
Okay.
Yeah, he's disfellowshipped in 1910 or 1911, and then in 1914 he's sent off to India.
Okay, well, tell us about John W. Taylor's excommunication, because that seems like it was some high drama in those meetings. Why don't you tell us about that and the revelation of his father that he produced at that court?
Yeah, this was really one of the things which made sure that polygamy didn't die. So they bring Taylor in, and Taylor is pretty defiant. He had refused to answer their summons multiple times. He at one point he'd gone in and he'd cursed George Smith. He'd cursed Francis Lyman, rather. And he had asked Joseph F. Smith to call on the Council of 50, this secret body who supposedly was running the political and religious affairs in Utah. Joseph F. basically laughed him off. So Taylor enters this thing really as the guy who they've managed to at least create an air of suspicion about, that he's the guy who's running everything. He's the guy who's behind all the secret new plural marriages. He's the guy who's sealing these new marriages. He's the guy who's, more importantly, giving the sealing powers to the patriarchs to do these things. So they really focus on Taylor, and a lot of it, I think, is personal animosity, to be honest, from Francis Lyman and some of these other apostles. Plus, they'd already sacrificed these guys publicly with the Smoot hearing. So Taylor comes in. He's arguing with the guys, really defiant, and says, basically, we cannot give it up because I have this. And he pulls out of his pocket a revelation signed by his father from 1886. And it eventually has a rather notorious career, but at that point, it's pretty secret. And he says, look, I found this in my father's papers after he died. And this says, it's from the Lord, and it says that you can't ever abandon plural marriage because it is an eternal law. And if God is an eternal God, how can he change his eternal laws? And this really seems like Taylor's going to come out of this thing not just unscathed, but entirely victorious. So he leaves that day, comes back, and basically they began to question the legitimacy of the of the 1886 revelation. They begin to question.
Do we have that? Do we have that original hard copy that people can examine and sort of test whether that is authentic? Compare it to the handwriting of President Taylor.
You can get a copy of it in Fred Collier's work, The Unpublished Revelations. It's a sort of photocopy, so, you know, purports to be that anyway. The actual copy I haven't seen. I don't know that you can actually see it if you go down to Temple Square. I don't think that they'll pull it out for you just to sort of give you a look.
I tried. They turned me down. No, just kidding. But I'm curious, though, because we're going to get into fundamentalism, and this really is the crux of the issue. And I'm curious, has anyone ever done any forensic examination of this 1886 purported revelation from John Taylor saying that we can never end polygamy?
Yeah, I don't know of any sort of formal analysis of it. I know D. Michael Quinn said, you know, it looks like Taylor's handwriting to him. And from what I've seen of Taylor's handwriting, it looks like Taylor's handwriting to me too, but I'm no expert.
Yeah. Well, certainly it would be in line with some of the things John Taylor said. I mean, am I not mistaken in that he was known to give sermons during his lifetime where he said effectively the same thing?
Yeah, that's the thing that really kind of puts the question about whether he wrote it or not almost irrelevant, is that he regularly said that we can't do this because it's an eternal law. And the sort of structure of the revelation is a series of questions and answers that Taylor gives, which really was his kind of mode of writing down a revelation, was to ask a question and then write down the answer. If you read some of his other revelations, you see the same kind of pattern. So, I mean, it strikes me as completely legitimate, and I have a hard time believing John W. Taylor fabricated it, or that he would have been fooled by something like, somebody wrote a note that looked like John Taylor's handwriting, and that John W. Taylor would have been fooled by it. So, to me, you know, the question of whether Taylor wrote it, I don't really have any doubts that he did write it. But again, how you begin to build fundamentalism on the back of that 1886 revelation is a different matter. You know, a lot of these apostles don't really doubt the 1886 revelation, at least at the time. What they doubted was whether John W. Taylor should be in opposition to the current stance of the church. And so here you have really the movement towards a kind of modern Mormonism, which is to say the current principles of the church can be in direct conflict with the past principles or even the past revelations, and that what matters is that you are abiding by the current norms. And Taylor had a hard time reconciling that with this idea of an eternal law.
So this is, you say that this is really when the Mormon doctrine that the current living prophet trumps the statements and revelations of all past prophets really gets defined and developed.
Well, I mean, I think that they had enunciated that doctrine for a long time, but they also said, you know, if it contradicts something from Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, then it's probably not true. And so they had, a kind of complicated relationship to it. But here it really is kind of put, really kind of where the rubber meets the road. Becomes, are you going to abide by it or not? Because this is the new rule. And I don't know that they'd really had sort of put people into that kind of position before, especially, you know, even apostles, where they were asked if they would abandon a previous law for a new law. That kind of question hadn't really been forced upon Mormons until this time. So it's something which, you know, again, begins to separate and create two new kinds of Mormonisms. One is this modern Mormonism, which really is a new kind of Mormonism, and fundamentalism, which is an attempt to go back to the old school Mormonism, and which is in a lot of ways a reaction against this new kind of Mormonism. So neither of them, of course, have any real historical continuity, if you look at certain principles, with the Mormonism of the 19th century. If you look at very generic principles, yes, of course, they can both claim true descent from these from the 19th century. And this really becomes where they begin to build new notions of priesthood among the fundamentalists, but also among the modern Latter-day Saints, in response in some ways to what the fundamentalists were claiming.
Yeah, so, I mean, basically what we have here is, when it comes to the issue of authority and priesthood succession, we've, you know, a lot of times we focus on the debate over where did the priesthood go and the priesthood keys go when Joseph Smith was killed. And you have a number of people coming forward and claiming that the keys were passed to them. What you're saying here is this is a period in history where actually for a second time now we have, for lack of a better term, a priesthood succession crisis, where you've got the fundamentalists saying they've got the priesthood via John Taylor's 1886 revelation and John W. Taylor and Musser and Woolley, although you haven't gotten to them yet. And then on the other hand, that the keys are still with Wilford Woodruff and his successors.
That's right. It's I think that's the proper way to look at it. It is a secession crisis. And what the fundamentalists claimed is that John Taylor's bodyguards were there when he received his 1886 revelation and were given the priesthood keys, because Taylor also said that that the time will come when the majority of the Latter-day Saints abandon the gospel and go into apostasy. And so he had made preparations, and the only surviving two members of this secret circle, which they later call the Circle of Friends, or the Quorum of the Friends, or the Seven Friends. One of them was John Woolley, who was an old guy who worked at the Salt Lake Temple, who was performing plural marriages in the Salt Lake Temple even up until 1914, 1915. All right, so you have Lauren Woolley and John Woolley, these two brothers, who claim to be the bodyguards with the Batemans as well in this 1886 episode. And John Woolley eventually dies. Lauren Woolley sort of holds on into the 1920s and starts to tell the story of this 1886 revelation, and doesn't just tell the story that the Lord gave this revelation to John Taylor, but says that he was there and that he has the keys to continue this, and that Joseph F. Smith gave the keys back to the Lord. And so the only remaining keys for the kingdom of God on the earth were with this Lauren Woolley character.
And this idea that Joseph F. Smith gave the keys back willingly or involuntarily?
Maybe both.
I imagine in any event, it was a, I guess, as a result of the church abandoning plural marriage.
That's right. And so the when he announces his 1918 revelation, which of course is the last one in the Latter-day Saints Doctrine and Covenants, the interpretation that Woolley gives of this is that that Joseph had given the keys back to these guys who he describes in the vision.
And so an alternate explanation maybe for why the Doctrine and Covenants ends there.
That's right. And so what you have here again is this kind of revival of an ability to read between the lines, which then becomes a kind of recruitment device for this burgeoning movement to restore real Mormonism among these people who had been kicked out of the church, among them Joe Musser. And Joe Musser, of course, wasn't even excommunicated until sometime later in the 1920s. And he has this argument back and forth, which I go into the dissertation, with Joseph Fielding Smith. And what happened is Joe Musser was at his ward in the Sugar House area and was sitting on the stand in a seat of honor and took the sacrament. And this is, of course, after he is a kind of notorious polygamist. And Joseph Fielding Smith is there, and really begins to ask whether Joe Musser has the right to take the sacrament, given his status in the church. And so here you begin to see the development of two different notions about priesthood. One among the Joseph Fielding Smith kind of segment, which is that the priesthood is connected to your membership in the church. If you're out of the church, you lose the priesthood.
So Musser had been excommunicated at this point, yet he's up on the stand?
Yes, he's up on the stand, which is how Joseph Fielding Smith saw him, I think. And of course, that seemed all the more disreputable to be taking it in such a public setting. The idea was that it would cause this kind of suspicion that we really did now again sanction plural marriage, because here you've got a guy who's kind of a well-known polygamist taking the sacrament with an apostle there. So, so Musser, however, puts the argument to Joseph Fielding Smith that his dad authorized him to take those plural wives, that Joseph Fielding Smith ought to know his own history, his family history, as well as sort of the history of the church, and that he doesn't seem to know this history, and that simply by being removed from the organization of the church doesn't in any sense have an effect on his priesthood. And this becomes the argument which the fundamentalists start to push, which is that they have an alternate line of priesthood authority, which comes from this 1886 event through the Woolleys and then is bestowed upon Joseph Musser. And he becomes the organizing point and starts to write a great deal of pamphlets, which he has subscribers to. This is amid the Great Depression. He abandons his failed oil company that he was involved in and a couple other failed endeavors and starts to write. And the first thing he writes is a synthesis of this 1886 event. And this is one of the things which fundamentalists now sort of have internal debates about, whether you descend from the Joseph Musser line or whether you descend from the Benjamin Franklin Johnson line, which I don't really go into in the dissertation. But what you find is that the fundamentalists by the 1930s began to replicate a much more sort of stripped down structure of authority, which is you have certain men who hold priesthood keys, and these men have absolute authority over their members. And if you leave or are kicked out of the LDS church, you are welcomed with open arms, because now you're among the sort of saving remnant of the kingdom of God.
In other words, if you're excommunicated, yeah, you're not a member of the church anymore, but you've still got your priesthood, and you can still be part of an organization of priesthood holders, and under the direction of priesthood holders, their priesthood just having come through a different line of succession.
That's right. And the question was whether they had more authority to do things like baptism, for example, or endowments, or whether they only had the ability to perform the sealing for plural marriage. And so these guys got together, and they were very sincere, trying to sort of petition heaven, as they called it. This is 1932, 1933, 1934. A group of guys, seven guys or so, who were petitioning heaven really on a weekly basis to receive authority to perform baptisms and to perform the sacrament and to perform all these things which they had sort of been accustomed to having as members of the LDS church. And in their diaries, they don't ever report receiving these kinds of keys or authorities. They fast. They go on what they call sexual fasts, which is they abstain from having sex. They abstain from food. They really go into every kind of sacrifice that they can think of. They try to make. They're very sincere. This is not just about having lots of women around or having authority over guys. But they were pushed by a lot of their new sort of members of their congregations to receive tithing. Was kind of the first thing that the members wanted to do. They wanted to pay their tithing. And so Joe Musser and these guys received their tithing, and they'd send a lot of it down to what is now Colorado City which is where they begin. They try to sort of start a consecrated community down in the desert.
So this is where we have the makings of another church. I mean, because at the beginning we had one church, but two lines of authority, supposedly, right? And so it looks like these folks in this other alternate, what we now call fundamentalist line of authority, they're starting to work out and ask questions about, well, what does our authority allow us to do? Is it limited to performing plural marriages, or can we do everything else that the church we've been excommunicated from does, baptisms and whatnot?
That's right. They begin to try to replicate the exact same ritual structure as well as structure of authority that they had encountered in the previous experience in Mormonism.
And this might be a good point to bring up something you mentioned, which was, the fundamentalists aren't really coming that far out of left field with this idea. When we're talking about priesthood and its relationship to church membership, because as you pointed out, the priesthood was restored through Joseph Smith in, is that 1829?
That's right.
And as we all know, the church was not organized until 1830. So Damon, explain for us then the fundamentalist argument about how the priesthood being restored in 1829, before the church was even organized, sort of in their mind establishes the idea that you can have priesthood exist without, separate and independent of a church existing.
Yeah, the idea was that the priesthood would always be on the earth, and it was on the earth in some sense to organize a church, but that this made the church dependent upon the priesthood. So this is their argument that they're making in the 1930s, is that any kind of church is an outgrowth, an appendage of the priesthood. Whereas the, for example, John Widtsoe writes Priesthood and Church Government, compiles these various statements from church leaders, presidents of the church, and so on, going back to Joseph Smith. And if you actually read it and you look at the chronology, there aren't any statements that make it clear that the church and the priesthood are perfectly correlated, as it were. What you do find, however, is you find these statements in the 1930s, and they were actually written by John Widtsoe, which make it clear that that your priesthood as an individual depends upon your membership in the church. And so the argument basically splits the two camps clearly, and what this does, it actually does a real favor for the Latter-day Saints, where if you want to practice polygamy, you don't have to be underground, and the church doesn't have to deal with these sort of suspicion of underground Mormons practicing polygamy and then possibly being made to seem like they're responsible for it. So the fundamentals actually do a real favor in terms of clarifying what a Mormon is and what a Mormon isn't, at least among Latter-day Saints. Now, it doesn't clarify things, of course, among the American population, and still hasn't. Most of them still view Mormons as polygamists, and this is in part because polygamists view themselves as Mormons. Latter-day Saints, however, are regularly troubled by this problem, this seeming misperception. So, what this does is it, by 1940, you have, just to sort of summarize, you have two notions of priesthood authority, and both of them are restructuring the way that people understand priesthood as authority. And prior to this, you have a notion of priesthood as the ability to perform certain covenants, but it's not really a kind of administrative authority. After the fundamentalists break off and position their notion of priesthood, in the Latter-day Saint Church, the idea of priesthood as preeminently about administrative authority really begins to flower.
So when we started this discussion, we said, we're going to discuss this sort of first set of chain reactions that leads the church leaders to ultimately decide in the 60s that we need this thing called correlation. And so you've just walked us through this first set of chain reactions, beginning with the federal prosecution of church leaders, which creates this sort of rampant paranoia and deception. It creates confusion when the manifesto comes out, which then creates a priesthood succession crisis. And so how, again, just to make sure our listeners are aware, how exactly do you tie this into correlation?
Yeah, so what you have here is a kind of, as it were, evolutionary selection, a kind of cultural selection of a group of people who are going to be treating public statements by a person who has a title, a president of the church, as definitively sincere, you know, a statement of the way heaven really wants things to be run, not as a smokescreen or a kind of deception. Those people would have been basically siphoned off and picked up by the fundamentalists. And so you have the kind of discursive confusion that led a great deal of problems up until 1910, dividing out, and you have this new church that I'm calling sort of the modern LDS church, which is built around the idea of public statements as being authoritative. And increasingly, the more sort of closer they are to real-time experience, the more authoritative they are. So what happens in the next general conference has sort of precedent over what happened in the previous general conferences. So this is the idea, very much the idea of a modern thing, right? Is kind of what's going on right now is what's to be regarded as authoritative. And the larger audience makes it, in some sense, more valid. Whereas among the fundamentalists, you have a sort of a real embrace of this notion of secrecy, that it's the secrecy and it's the secret that is more to be regarded as true, that God, in some sense, reveals through secrets rather than through through satellite distribution outlets. So here you have a division in terms of how truth is going to be distributed and the ways that people can be trained to recognize something as being true. So is it because it's public or because it's secret? Is it because it's coming from the president of the church, or is it because it's coming from somebody who claims a kind of secret lineage that goes back to the 19th century rather than a kind of public lineage? So this is the modern church here is really laying the foundation for making possible something like correlation. But we're still, you know, a little bit of ways from actually what brings about correlation. You've mentioned the main part here is, of course, a concern over priesthood authority and how do members recognize legitimate priesthood authority versus illegitimate. And the easy answer to this is if this guy operates in public and says something in public and you agree to that, he's your authority. If you don't, then you've got another group of people you can join up with who operate in kind of person-to-person networks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.